Today, here on Cincy Business Talk with Mike Roth, Cincinnati's most experienced Sandler trainer. We'll be talking to business leaders about how they have grown their businesses and people. We discuss new strategies, tactics, and philosophies which lead to positive growth in our marketplace. Our program is sponsored by Sandler Training by Roth & Associates. Each week, we'll talk with our best Cincinnati area top executives about their tools and insights. Our regular listeners will be given the edge that will help them win in a competitive environment which we live. Simple solutions to complex problems which challenge all of us are rarely correct. We will address complex problems or opportunities with appropriate solutions. If you have questions or comments, contact Mike at mikeroth@rothconsulting.net or call Mike at 513-753-9400. Now your host, Cincinnati's most experienced Sandler trainer, Mike Roth.
Thanks, Scott. This is Mike Roth and Ed Kleinman on today's show, number 250 in the Cincinnati Business Talk radio show series. In today's show, Ed is in Baltimore, Maryland. Say hi to everybody, Ed.
Hi, everybody.
Very hot Baltimore. Good. Ed, let me suggest that you speak closer to the microphone. Before we get started, let me tell everyone about a couple of upcoming events here at Sandler in September and October. We have a Sandler boot camp, 8-hour sales training day on Sandler Foundations on September 23rd. Later in the month, we have a 7-hour Sandler Enterprise Selling System boot camp. This is the brand new Sandler Enterprise System, which is strategic as opposed to tactical for large accounts, long selling cycles, expensive pursuits. And it's all about retaining accounts long-term. Features six new segments as well as 13 brand-new Sandler tools. We'll be taking everyone through all of the segments and tools, and then we'll spend some time on each one of the tools. It won't be in-depth, but we're going to take you through, and you will get some really good knowledge, and you'll be able to make a determination whether or not you need to go further. Every company is different. But when you deal with a long lead time, a 2 or 3 year sales cycle, and $150,000 to $300,000 cost of pursuing an opportunity, at the beginning you ought to have a really good methodology to tell whether or not you're going to be able to win. In the Sandler boot camp, some of the things we're going to cover are identifying the reasons to do business, questioning strategy, prospecting, how to close the sale, and how to improve your behavior, attitude, and technique. And if you're interested in either one of those two programs, you can contact Brittany here at our office at 513-753-9400, extension 106. Okay, let me tell everyone about you a little bit, Ed. Ed, since he was a little kid, enjoyed music, everything from blues and jazz to the early days of rock and roll, folk, jazz, and singers and songwriters. And Ed spent 18 years working on the road with bands, starting out as a true roadie. That was an unpaid roadie, huh, Ed?
I was an unpaid in the beginning. Friends of mine, the Blues Project. Go hang out. Just sit around and watch the camp and do this and do that. So you start helping them. And eventually, somebody in the band came back. Al Cooper came up to me and said, "I keep seeing you hanging out here and helping you, helping Don. I guess you're friends. By the way, would you look for us? I had done night school for a couple of years and I transferred over to college, and I was off all summer. before I started as a pilot back to college. I said, Spirit, and they said, we'll give you $4 a week to buy somebody for food, and we'll pay any hotel that are. I said, great,
I said, great.
I just thought that I was so old. I thought the whole thing was just kind of a, wow, I'm 21 years old, the world is amazing. We're based out of Greenwich Village. There were people all over Greenwich Village. Runaways, police, clear runaways, peace lovers, This was and I'm working with a band, and I can get some young woman into the club with me or come on stage. Okay. 21 years old. I'll take that.
Okay, so you were in heaven at 21 in the rock and roll business.
As I was told, if anybody asks, you're with the band. Okay, I can do that.
Yep, you're with the band. Those were, I guess, in the days before there was both of our. My quality audit person reports that we have a high echo, Ed.
Okay. Let me lower the volume and get a little closer to my help.
Yeah, you got to get a lot closer to the microphone and turn the speakers way down, Ed.
Okay. I have no idea where the mic is on. Let's try that. Is this working? Is that a little better?
A little bit better. Kind of stick with it where you think the microphone is. And you went on
from, I can get without bending my head against my screen on the laptop.
Yeah. It's a good thing then that this is not a picture phone conference.
No. Would calling in on telephone?
And why don't you do that? Why don't you call in on 646-595-4916?
Hold on here. I'm ready to go. Is the area code?
It's a New York City area code.
Okay, I got it right here.
646-595-4916. Okay. While we're waiting for Ed to call back in, we're going to run a short Sandler commercial.
Think about this for a second. You graduate from college and decide on a career in sales. How much of your formal education was focused on sales skills? You know, the thing you're about to rely on to make a living. Zero. Hi, this is Mike Roth of Roth & Associates, the most experienced Sandler sales trainer in Cincinnati. Why is selling the only profession that people believe you can just walk in and be successful as long as you have a great personality and a little bit of ambition? No matter how skilled and knowledgeable you are in your field, whether it's finance, technology, or any other, you starve if you can't sell your products or services. For over 15 years, we've been training, coaching, and mentoring business owners and sales professionals who are committed to taking control of their careers. To find out how Sandler training can make you better, faster, and stronger, register now for our next Lunch and Learn. Call me, Mike Roth, Cincinnati's most experienced sales trainer, at 513-646-6523. Let's talk. 513-646-6523. Why do some business owners make lots of money while others endure years of mediocrity? Is it really the economy, the market, the weather, the competition? No. These are all called excuses, which are always plentiful. Hi, I'm Mike Roth, founder of Roth & Associates. I'm the most experienced Sandler sales trainer in Cincinnati. As a business owner or part of a team, are you accepting excuses from your sales team because you make them yourself? Business winners succeed in spite of this trash. Business winners invest in themselves and their people. For over 15 years, we've been coaching, training, and challenging professionals who are 100% committed to long-term sales growth and profitability, no matter what it takes. If you're deadly serious about increasing your sales, call me at 513-646-6523. I'm the most experienced Sandler sales trainer in Cincinnati. To find out how Sandler training can make you better, faster, and stronger, call 513-646-6523.
This is Mike Roth here with Ed Kleinman. And Ed has agreed to take questions from our listeners. So if you have a question during the show, call in on 646-595-4916, and we will answer the calls during the commercial, screen the calls during the commercial breaks, and hopefully get them on within a few minutes. Ed, you've also written a new book called Joint Venture, A Backstage Rock and Roll Journey. What was your motivation to put the book together?
I had a couple of friends that kept saying to me, you know, you're getting older. Why don't you write down what you were doing? And I started 3 years ago. The book has been out about a year and a half, almost 2 years. And it's about what goes on. You go to a show. You want that artist, whatever, to be fantastic. You don't want to walk out and say, that sucked. But behind the stage, there's a lot that goes on. And that's where the roadies, tour managers, lights, cameras, action, all the stuff that goes on to make that show good, besides how good the band is or the artist. Mm-hmm. And we're all on stage. You're on stage. You just did a big talk about new Stanley stuff coming on. People that come to see that, you're going to perform for them. They go to their client. They're really performing. And they have to do it right. And this way, that client will buy their products or services and will tell their friends, their other clients, by the way, you want to talk to Mike Ross. We're all on stage no matter what we do. And I thought it would be great to show what really goes on backstage to make that show what it should be so that those fans tell their friends. And you start out, let's say you're a solo performer in a bar. You know, a year later, 2 years later, you're in an arena. Because you performed well. It doesn't matter what business you're in. You're still basically on stage. And I went that route with it.
Right, right. And I kind of love the picture on the cover of the book, and people will be able to see that. It's a picture of a regular glass type ashtray with a looks like a joint in it.
Well, there's a story to that. I'd rather not give the story away over on the phone, because if people want to read the book, it's available on Amazon.com, Barnes and Noble. You can get it in an ebook. You can get it in hardcover, soft cover.
So it's available on Amazon.com.
There because, well, in 1966, I knew how to roll one of those. The people I was working for didn't.
Yeah, in the book, I thought I read a segment where it said that you rolled better joints than the guys in the band. Therefore, they had you teach them how to roll a better joint.
The other roadies, the tour manager and the other roadies, that's where we worked it.
Good, good. How long did it take you to put the book together, Ed?
It took me 3 months to write it. Mm-hmm. It took another maybe 4 or 5 months for editing. I used my own editors. I didn't use the publishing company's editors. I wanted the book to sound like we're sitting down talking about this. You know, you said to me, you're in the music industry. What's that all about? And I tell you a story. So by the time it took probably about 9 months to get it out, 9-10 months to get it out.
Mm-hmm.
And doing a lot of interviews over the last 2 years. I've done blog talk radio about 4 or 5 times already.
Mm-hmm.
Different
mm-hmm.
people running the shows.
Right. And how did you accumulate the photographs that you have in the book?
Well, I got as many as I could. Some of the people
you
I knew.
You were a photographer when you were a roadie?
No. But I knew some of the people. Bill was friendly with some of the people, some from Elephant's Memory, some from the Stranglers. I went online, and I put in the name of the bands. And I searched through online. I talked to the people that I could find. They sent me pictures. And we took it from there. I didn't get all the pictures. I got no Blood, Sweat, and Tears pictures. I've got no Al Cooper pictures from Blues Project days.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to be careful with LeBlanc and Carr. I don't think I put a picture of them in there. That's the sad part of the book, you know, with Lynyrd Skynyrd. And so I got as many as I could to put in.
Right, right.
Got to thank the internet.
Hey. it's hard to tell. So let's go back to the beginning. Before we do that, again, if you wanted to call in with a question for Ed or me, 646-595-4916. So you grew up in Jersey City and you had friends in New York, and you hung around Washington Square Park at near NYU.
Bleecker Street, McDougal Street, where all the beatniks were doing their poetry, the folk singers were doing it, and then, of course, it turned into the hippie world.
Right, right.
The youth movement, so to speak. And
so
we were all young.
What drew you down there from Jersey City?
What drew me down?
Mm-hmm.
That was easy.
When
I was a young teenager, I got hooked on On the Road. I'm going blank on his name, the writer's name. Terrible. But I started sneaking into the village. Listening to poetry, hanging out in the coffee house. I was 14 years old. And I met people that were New Yorkers, but we're all the same age. And, you know, you start hanging out and you start finding that there's other things in life than just living across the river.
Right, right.
You know, and that it was good stuff. It was good stuff. Met a lot of people. And I learned, you know, when I was writing the book and looking at that era and beyond, I learned how important relationship building is.
Mm-hmm.
And,
people trust.
Turns out, you gain people's trust. It's relationship building, and you later on in my rock and roll days, including when I graduated college, I was getting phone calls from people I didn't know, but they had heard about me, got my phone number, and I'd go to work. Maybe I'd go out for a month. Maybe I'd go out for a week. Whatever, as a tour manager at that time. But it's because of the job you did. And if you do a good job and you do it right the first time, you realize you got a lot of free time. The band's not bothering you. You're not changing tubes in those days. You're not stringing guitars. Everything's working. They finished their rehearsal. You're back out on the street hanging out in one of the bars or clubs that you wanted to go to.
When you started, were they still using tube amps, or had they switched over?
Most of it was tube amps.
Those boys were really heavy.
Were they ever?
They had a good back to move them around. I had a friend who ran a couple of bands. In the process of starting at the bottom, which is, you know, literally what you did in the music business, and you worked your way up to being an agent and a band manager.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell our listeners?
I was a tour manager. And that means, you know, I had roadies underneath me, so to speak, but I never looked at it. I had done their job. They knew their job. The sound people knew their jobs. The lighting people knew their jobs. I'm the one that made sure they got paid. I'm the one that made sure the band got paid, that everybody was taking care of the band on the road, from the press to the hotels to the drivers of the trucks to the buses to the roadies. To keep handing them money to go get an amp fixed because we need it fixed for the next show. And we're in the middle of nowhere. We're in Cincinnati, and we're New Yorkers. How do you get the amp fixed?
I haven't the faintest idea. You find a local repair shop. In 1968, you didn't have the internet to tell you where the repair shop was.
No, but before we got on the road, there was a lot of pre-work done, so we knew where the music shops are, and the people that ran the shows, the promoters knew where they were. So if we needed something, we could call ahead as we were going.
That's pre-cell phone era. You had to stop the bus someplace to call ahead.
Yeah. Most phones were at gas stations.
Okay. Why don't you tell our listeners the story of the time that you were managing the band and you had to be on stage holding the cymbal up?
The New York World's Fair Pavilion. Huge, circular, I don't know, probably held 10,000, 15,000 people with no seats.
Right, that's
with
the point.
It was
in
Men
in Black.
The Rhinoceros was a supergroup, so to speak. People from various other bands that got together, and we had an instrumental called Apricot Brandy that was being played all over the place. So here we are. They're on stage. Cymbal break. It turns out to be a main cymbal for the drummer, who was probably one of the nicest guys you'd ever meet. Well, the roadies were busy doing that stuff. Nobody could do anything. I was the only one that could hold up that cymbal till it was a break to get it fixed. Nothing like listening to the music with your head underneath a cymbal and the drums beating on you. I'm surprised I'm still not deaf.
So in those days, did you go on stage with earplugs in your ears?
You know, I'm not sure I knew anybody back in those days that used earplugs. I started to see them back in the late 70s, early 80s. And Jack Kerouac was the author that I had read when I was 13, 14 years old.
Ah, yes.
Just to go back for a minute. I hate forgetting stuff.
Okay, well, you came up with it. We're going to take a 2-minute break here. And again, if you have any questions, you can call in and ask Ed the question on 646-595-4916. Now, since this is a music show, let's see if we can play some Sandler rap.
You can always put John Lennon on.
I guess Sandler rap is in hi-fi and today's show is in lo-fi, so I'm going to go to a regular commercial.
All right.
When that happens, let's see. Bing Shop.
Imagine you just left your prospect's office and he now has your proposal, quote, or estimate. What do you suppose he's going to do with that valuable information that you just gave him for free? Call you tomorrow with an order? Get real! He's shopping it around to the competition. Hi, this is Mike Roth, founder of Roth & Associates. I'm the most experienced Sandler sales trainer in Cincinnati. I'm constantly amazed how salespeople operate. They believe a prospect asking for a proposal means the sale is as good as closed. Face it, trained prospects will turn you into an unpaid consultant. For over 15 years, we've been coaching, training, and challenging professionals who are 100% committed to long-term sales growth and profitability, no matter what it takes. If you're deadly serious about increasing sales, call me at 513-646-6523. Find out how Sandler Training can make you better, faster, and stronger. Or register now for our next open house, 513-646-6523. This is Mike Roth, the most experienced Sandler sales trainer in Cincinnati. This is Mike Roth, Cincinnati's most experienced Sandler trainer. Many salespeople tell us business was really easy. They likened it to gathering fruit in an orchard full of ripe trees. They gathered the low-hanging fruit. They had to get baskets to pick up the fruit that was already fallen. They never had to climb a tree. They worked this way for 10 or 15 years. Given the strong economy, this was no problem. What are you hearing now? The economy has slowed down. Salespeople are competing on price. There's still business now, but salespeople have to work harder. The fruit has not fallen from the tree, and there's no low-hanging fruit. The fruit is there, but it's higher up in the tree. The problem is their salespeople have forgotten how to climb. Do your salespeople know how to climb? If you or your team needs to learn how to climb through and up out of tough economic times, call me, Mike Roth, at 513-646-6523 or check our website at rothconsulting.net.
This is Mike Roth. I'm back with Ed Kleinman. Ed, if people want to learn more about your book and maybe even hear a little bit of the music that the bands were doing in the time, where do they go on the web?
Well, for the book, it has its own website. It's www.jointventurejourney.com, and there's excerpts of the book there and a few little odds and ends. It's a nice website. And for the music, for every band I worked with, if you go to www.facebook.com/ joint venture journey. And you'll come to the page and just scroll down. There's videos of everybody I worked with, from John and Yoko and Elephant's Memory to Blood, Sweat, and Tears, to the Stranglers in England, who are still at it. They're still working on their 40th anniversary tour, and I'm still in touch with a couple people involved in that band.
Good. Why don't you tell our listeners how you ran into John Lennon and Yoko Ono?
I worked for a band called, I only worked for them for a little bit, this band. And Gary Van Dyke and Adam Indolino were players in that band, bass player and keyboard player.
Mm-hmm.
Out of nowhere, I had gone to California, spent a year in San Francisco, and I had a roommate there who had a bunch of money, and we promoted some shows out there. It kind of ended, and I came back at the end of the year. I got a phone call from Gary Van Dyke saying, "Hey, Ed, how are you?" And I hadn't talked to him maybe in a year or two.
So for our listeners, tell everyone who Gary is.
Gary Van Dyke is a bass player, still a bass player, and he was a bass player in a band that I'd worked with at one time for about a year. And I got a call out of nowhere. "How are you? Blah, blah, blah." And he goes, "Hey, by the way, you're looking for a job?" And I said, "Yeah, I mean, I just got back from California. I'm a little tired from the drive, but yes, I'd like to go back to work." And he said, "Well, we have a band called Elephant Memory. How'd you like to interview for us?" I said, "Great, no problem. Gave me the address. And I didn't know anything about this band. I had no idea who they were, nothing. I go with it, they asked me to go, and kind of a West Village, kind of a neat, it was just a first floor, but it was a rehearsal studio. As soon as you walk in, you knew they rehearsed there.
Okay.
And there were five members of the band, including the two people I knew, Gary and Adam. And they spent about an hour or so asking me questions. What would you do with this? And what do you know? Who'd you work with? Blah, blah, blah. On and on and on and on and on. And I guess I answered them right, because one of the guys turned around and said, "When can you start?" And I said, "Oh, if I got the job, now, tomorrow."
Okay. Tomorrow.
And they said, "That'd be great. We're rehearsing tomorrow. Come to here for rehearsal." And then one of the guys turned around and said, "Oh, by the way, we're the backup band for John and Yoko." And I was very cool. I didn't faint or, you know, hold my heart and go, "I'm out of breath." All I said was, "Cool, see you tomorrow."
I did all the rest of that when I got outside myself.
You know, my God.
And for people who aren't in the music business, what does the backup band mean?
You support John and Yoko. They do their song, play whatever they're going to play, but you're really the backup band for all their tunes. You got the drums, the bass, the guitar, the keyboards. You are the band that's backing up what they're doing.
So you're the band that's playing. So this band called Elephant's Memory was the band behind John Lennon and Yoko Ono's albums?
A couple New York albums, and then he produced a couple of their albums. And they did a couple shows. They did a couple big shows together, and then Elephant's Memory was out touring on their own too.
Mm-hmm.
So we were out there running around the country, playing shows.
How long did you actually work with Elephant's Memory?
2 years.
2 years.
Approximately mm-hmm. 2 years. Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of studio work with John and Yoko.
Mm-hmm. What kind of people were John and Yoko as individuals?
As individuals, the first time I met John, he was in the studio. It was late at night, and I was pretty tired. So was all the other road crew. Everybody was pretty tired, just sitting around waiting to see if somebody needed something. And he'd come out and tell some jokes, and nice guy. Watching both of them work was amazing. How zoned in they were on their music, on what they wanted from their music, what they wanted it to sound like in a coming out of the amps, you know, speakers and everything. So into it. Like, you just kind of mouth would fall open, go, "Oh, my God, these guys really know what they want." Whether you liked what they did or not, it's a different story.
Right.
That's musical taste. But
but they were professional.
They were so
in the way
good. And there were times that, you know, there was a bar called Home that we all hung out in. There were times that, you know, I'd spend a little time with John, and there were times that I would drive him home, drink a little bit too much, you know. It's very hard, you know, when you got the government, the United States was trying to tell John he couldn't stay in the States. New York City had their own Beatles. So everybody and their uncle wanted to know John Lennon. A lot of pressure.
Right.
He did a great job handling it, even though people look back and say he did a sucky job at times. But he straightened it all out. You know, they had a son, Sean, and he went on to live his life until somebody took it away.
Never sad. Yeah.
I was in London when that happened. I was already having my own management company. And I got a phone call, woke me up, I don't know, 5 o'clock in the morning from my wife. Well, she wasn't my wife yet. Let's unplug that. Anyway, and she told me the story, and I was in shock. And I was on my way over eventually that I had a meeting at EMI Records, which had something to do with the Beatles over in England. And it was just so sad. It was so sad. You know, there are a couple sad things that happen while you're on the road and when you're with bands. There's another story in there with Lynyrd Skynyrd, which was probably, I think that might have been my saddest piece on the road. I mean, they were out doing this tour for supporting their album. The tour was, this was midsummer, and it was supposed to go till February and end in Hawaii. And we were the opening act for the same management company.
Right.
And here we are in Tampa, if I remember correctly. And one of the lead singers, background singers, she was the brother of Cassie, her name was. She was the brother of the lead singer. She's backstage, and she's crying and screaming, and I don't want to get on the airplane. I don't want to. Never knew why she didn't get on it, but it was sad watching her. You know, like, come on, let her go ride the truck. The truck has got to get to the same place. I mean, I would have been in the truck, but I had nothing to do with that band other than we were the opening act.
Right.
Well, she died in that plane crash that they had. We drove. We were the drivers. We drove to Baton Rouge. And in those days, if you put the radio on, mostly you got static. Unless you were near a big city, and then you'd have to look for a station. So we didn't know what happened. We got to the hotel, and they're checking us in, and the guy turns around and says, "Do you know what happened?" No, we don't know what happened. We just got here. And he told us about the plane crash. And of course, the managers were the same management company, so they were getting together. Everything was, you know, getting itself together. But it was sad because she didn't want to get on that bus. On the plane, rather. And it's just, you know, to see something like that happen. I fell in love with the band. I wasn't a big fan until I watched these guys on stage, and they were amazing. They did stuff that I didn't know of.
As a non-rock and roll roadie, it seemed as almost like a bad vibe for a singer to get on a plane, a private plane, like Rick Nelson, the Big Bopper.
Yeah. It's happened to a lot of people.
Yeah.
If you go back and go to the internet and say musicians died in the plane crashes, you'll see a whole lot.
Of course, they were moving between cities, sometimes on short schedules. Until I read your book, I didn't think about the guys who were on the road driving the trucks with the equipment.
Oh, there's accidents in that. There's even a story in my book with the Stranglers, their first show in New York City, first show on a three-month tour. The roadies finished up the show. It was good. It was a great show. I was there. They went to a friend's house to take a shower because they had to get in the truck and drive to wherever they were going, Cleveland, Cincinnati. Who knows where the next show was. But the truck got stolen. And it was all gone. Everything. The only thing that was left over were the guy's guitars and bass and stuff like that because they took them back to the hotel. And this is where you find out one of the lessons learned in that book, you know, when something like that comes down, we were managing the band. So I went to the band and said, "Do you guys want to finish this tour or do you want to go back to England? You know, it's your choice." And they said they'd like to finish it. I said, then we'll start renting the equipment as we go along, and you'll do the best you can. I'll back it. You can pay me back when you get back to the UK or whatever. Don't worry about it. Right now, the tour is what's important. And from the roadies to the sound to the lights to myself to my wife, who eventually became my wife, the booking agents, the record company, we made that tour happen, and everybody worked as a team. And working as a team sometimes is the most important thing you can do. Oh, yeah, some people bitched and moaned at times, but it wasn't at the band. It wasn't at the circumstances other than, oh, I can't get the right amp in this town, you know. So we rented as much as we could in New York. And when we got, I had a management partner, and when we got to Los Angeles, he flew down from San Francisco, and he gave every one of the roadies a $100 bill and said, you got a couple days off, go have fun.
Go have fun.
That's 1979, no, maybe 1980. And $100 went a long way those days.
Yeah, okay.
But teamwork is important no matter what you do, and I don't care. It's, again, back to lessons learned. And these were things that when I was writing the book, all of a sudden I would say, wow, right, that's a lesson there. I mean, I can work as a team. I had done that in coaching business. You know, you're coaching 40, 50 people or whatever it is. And you got to be on the ball, and you got to work together to make it happen for your client. And when you're on the road, you got to make it work for your audience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard.
As I was reading through your book, Ed, there's a chapter called Moving On to the Unknown and Some Surprises. After we come back from a couple of short Sandler commercials, we'll be talking about that. The number you can call in to ask Ed a question directly is, as always, 646-595-4916.
In a world of quick weight loss, extreme makeovers, and everything else at warp speed, it makes sense for salespeople to expect instant results from one-day training programs. Hi, this is Mike Roth, founder of Roth & Associates. I'm the most experienced Sandler sales trainer in Cincinnati. Do you think the number one golfer in the world learned to play at a seminar? Of course not. Without daily practice, coaching, and reinforcement, he'd be an 18 handicap. So why would you try to build your professional sales skills and your career with a quick seminar and a $79.95 rah-rah session? For over 15 years, we've been coaching, training, and challenging professionals who are 100% committed to long-term sales growth and profitability, no matter what it takes. If you're deadly serious about increasing sales, call me at Roth & Associates, 513-646-6523. To find out how Sandler Training can make you better, faster, and stronger, or register now for our next open house, call me at 513-646-6523. This is Mike Roth, Cincinnati's most experienced Sandler trainer. Many salespeople tell us business was really easy. They likened it to gathering fruit in an orchard full of ripe trees. They gathered the low-hanging fruit. They had to get baskets to pick up the fruit that was already fallen. They never had to climb a tree. They worked this way for 10 or 15 years. Given the strong economy, this was no problem. What are you hearing now? The economy has slowed down. Salespeople are competing on price. There's still business now, but salespeople have to work harder. The fruit has not fallen from the tree, and there's no low-hanging fruit. The fruit is there, but it's higher up in the tree. The problem is their salespeople have forgotten how to climb. Do your salespeople know how to climb? If you or your team needs to learn how to climb through and up out of tough economic times, call me, Mike Roth, at 513-646-6523 or check our website at rothconsulting.net.
This is Mike Roth with Ed Kleinman. Ed, you have a chapter called Moving On and to the Unknown and Some Surprises. What struck me was the statement in that chapter, earlier in the chapter, when you say, I learned a lot, mostly what not to do. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that for our clients and listeners?
By this time, you know, I had watched other bands, other people, and one of the things that I found, you know, that was very important was, mm-hmm. you know, skip the drugs, gang. You got a performance to do. You got to work. You got amplifiers. You got to get in that truck and drive to the next town. And when you're based in New York, a lot of stuff was done in the, you know, in the Chicago, to Cleveland, to Cincinnati. For some of us that don't know any better, the Midwest. And there was these tours that would go through all of this. You have a lot to do there. And what not to do? What, don't get, you know, save everything for the days off that you have. And if you want to get wasted. But don't get wasted don't while you've got a show to go on. And that goes for the musicians, too.
Mm-hmm.
I've watched musicians fall over on stage, pass out, bleed from their nose because they were doing stuff that they shouldn't have been doing.
Yeah,
And you want to do it right, because that's what really counts.
I understand. I understand completely. One time I was in Vegas. I think I was there for a CES show and had some time, so I caught a Jerry Lee Lewis show where he comes on stage with his piano.
And
he had to be drunk with doing the show. He got about halfway through it, and I said to my wife, "We'll leave it," because he was terrible. It was unbelievable. Unbelievable that he would come out on stage in that condition, or his management company would allow him to come out.
At the end of the book, I have a lesson learned, and it is in capital letters, final lesson learned. Keep the joint ventures for your days off. Those who are successful are always learning, no matter what arena you are performing in. Believe in yourself. Always have goals. It's not about you. It's about your fans or your clients. Be the best you can. I can't say it enough. Perform at your maximum all the time. Practice and learn, and most of all, keep rocking. I think that is, I mean, there's stories in the book of people, I consider people that passed on success because maybe they didn't believe in themselves. You know, I get a record deal for the first band I ever managed. These were guys I went to college with, and I get a record deal on Columbia Records. Everybody knows that label.
Good record.
I gave up my 10% of the royalties for the guy that put the deal together for me because I was friends with him, but he didn't want to do it for nothing, and he was a fairly well-known agent, and I didn't care. It wasn't about me. It was about getting this album out for this band because they were good, and they had great vocals, and the timing was good. Well, they went to Johnny, his name was. They went to Johnny and said, "Hey, Johnny, we know you helped Ed get the record deal. We'd like you to manage us." And Johnny turned around and said, "If Ed doesn't manage you, you don't have a record deal." He told him to get out. He called me up right away. And I went over and saw them and said, "I just heard about that. You guys don't trust me enough that you wanted somebody else for a manager. Well, go find one because I'm gone and this record deal is done." And I walked. Sometimes you got to walk on stuff, and you know this in your business. Some people are not, they may be trainable, but you're the wrong person to train them. They'll give you headaches all the time, and you'll get gray hair all the time. You got to, and that's again, back to building relationships. I built a relationship with Johnny that he was going to protect me, and he gave up who knows what. It could have been. But you know what? The funny one about it is the band had, we had an amazing amount of demos done by some, you know, from Todd Rundgren, if people know who that is, to people from various other bands. I mean, it's just amazing what I was able to get done for them out of New York City from Connections. And they never took that stuff and went looking for another manager. They could have. I mean, you're in New York. You're, you know, across the river from New York. Come on. There's a million managers. Could have got another manager. They didn't do it. What made me always think that maybe they didn't believe in themselves.
It was a
they
piece
were too
missing.
Busy with other people with telling other people, them, "Oh, you're great, you're great, you're great," but they couldn't tell themselves, "We're great. Let's keep going." And they never did. There's one guy that I'm still friendly with. At times, he does. He's a bartender, and he does a Neil Diamond show at supper clubs. Yeah, that's exciting.
Yeah. Well, it shows. You know, two ingredients of good business, in my belief, are, you know, honesty and integrity. And
even though there's a lot of lacking that, there's a lot of, I mean, music business has changed so much. Anybody can put out a CD now. Always put your stuff online and give people a website here. Go listen to my music. YouTube stars have come out of YouTube. You know, all of a sudden, somebody has a million people have watch their video, and all of a sudden they got a record deal on that record. It's a different world. You still have to create that music, and you still have to work hard and be great at your performance, at least as best as you can. I mean, everybody, you know, again, back to, it doesn't matter what business you're in, what your product is, or what your service is, you perform to your maximum, and you'll go someplace. And believe in yourself. If you don't believe in yourself, give it up.
Good. We're going to take a short commercial break here. Again, if you want to call in and ask Ed a question, 646-595-4916.
There we go.
This is Mike Roth, Cincinnati's most experienced Sandler trainer. Many salespeople tell us business was really easy. They likened it to gathering fruit in an orchard full of ripe trees. They gathered the low-hanging fruit. They had to get baskets to pick up the fruit that was already fallen. They never had to climb a tree. They worked this way for 10 or 15 years. Given the strong economy, this was no problem. What are you hearing now? The economy has slowed down. Salespeople are competing on price. There's still business now, but salespeople have to work harder. The fruit has not fallen from the tree, and there's no low-hanging fruit. The fruit is there, but it's higher up in the tree. The problem is their salespeople have forgotten how to climb. Do your salespeople know how to climb? If you or your team needs to learn how to climb through and up out of tough economic times, call me, Mike Roth, 513-646-6523, or check our website at rothconsulting.net. Draw me a picture of your sales force. 5% at the top, you know, the overachievers who are successful no matter what. The 65% in the middle, when things are good, hold margins at least once in a while. And of course, the pink slip candidates. You know the ones in your desk drawer. You hold out hope that they're going to do better and never do. Hi, this is Mike Roth, founder of Roth & Associates, the most experienced Sandler sales trainer in Cincinnati. Does that sound familiar? Pretty typical sales force, huh? The problem is the bottom feeders suck up the profits that the top producers work so hard to hold, and the mediocre ones in the middle, they barely hold enough to stay on the payroll. Are you willing to live with that, or are you ready to make some tough changes? For over 15 years, we've been training, coaching, and mentoring owners, managers, and professional salespeople who are committed to taking their careers to a higher level. To find out how Sandler Training can make you better, faster, and stronger, register now for our next open house. Call me at 513-646-6523.
Okay, this is Mike Roth and Ed Kleinman. Ed, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about a band that they have, I'm sure, heard of, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and what was your involvement with them?
Yeah, okay. I started out with the Blues Project, and Al Cooper was the keyboard player in that band. And he had some dreams of going to Europe and playing with Stevie Winwood, if I'm not mistaken, and doing a whole bunch of stuff that he did. When he came back, he put together the original Blood, Sweat, and Tears, which did the first album, his Child is a Father to Man. And it was a great album, great album. What went on internally? Well, you know, that's stuff that's not worth talking about because it's their stuff that they did. And at some point, Al Cooper was taken out of the band. Cooper was taken out of the band. And they were great. I mean, you have four horn players in there. You had great drum. Everybody was, they're incredible, that first band. But they were just as incredible with David Clayton Thomas as a second singer that they brought in, who also happened to be a very good guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the guys in the band who played guitar had some problems with him playing his guitar. He was better than the other guys.
Mm-hmm.
But not my band, place to say. But David was a really nice guy. And there was a time on the road that we were roommates. It just ended up that way. And he was writing a song called Spinning Wheel. And my joke always is, I heard that song every single night, at least 30, 40 times every single night before we fell asleep. And it was amazing. It was probably the only song in the whole world that I knew all the words to it at that time. But it was
30 or 40 times.
It was great. It was great to work with horn bands.
Mm-hmm.
From the rock blues project, bluesy, rocky, some very commercial, folky type stuff they did, because it was a time. That was 1966, 67. To more, bigger, better, kind of fact, Blood, Sweat, and Tears did the Ed Sullivan Show. We did that, and then that big party afterwards, they were getting ready to do a European tour, and I was asked, are you going to come on tour with us? And my answer was, I'd love to. The problem is that I'm almost done with school now. I graduate in May, and I'm the one that went back to school. I'm the one that wanted to go to college. My family didn't force me into that, and I'm going to graduate. And you know what the management, and they all said? They said, great, go do it, you know? Because you built that again. You go back and you built those kind of relationships where, you know, they know who you are, and you know who they are, with all our faults and all our pluses, you know, especially when you travel around on buses and you're living in hotels. And, you know, you forget, you don't even know what your next town is. You just know that the driver knows where he's going, you know.
Right, right. I want to steer the conversation here to something you wrote in one of the later chapters in the book. And I'm just going to quote it and ask you to comment on it. What you said is, as the manager, you have to be their trusted advisor.
Yeah.
Tell us
yeah.
how you see that.
I saw that in... not only in the bands, they need to count on you to get the job done. And I know I've said that many times, but there are a lot of things that go on. I mean, these guys are writing songs. They need to be published. They gotta be, is their publishing company good? Is their agent good? They expect, when they turn around and say, let's go out on tour, you're the one that's got to put it together. And you're the one that's got to bring it to them and say, this is what we got. This is where we're getting played. This is where we got to go. We set up the press with people on the road. They've got to be able to do it. They got to know that you're not going to screw them. And I watched over the years, I've watched other management companies as a roadie or a tour manager really do a job on the bands. I mean, there are people out there that are collecting lifelong money from bands that they managed 25, 30 years ago, and they're still collecting money on their, you know, recordings or publishing or whatever. When I got out of the business, our deal with the bands were, we'll find you a manager that you like, that you can work with, and we're done. You don't owe me anything. If I'm not going to do the work, then why should I get paid for something that I've already been paid on up to the moment? I also did something that I thought was fair, too. And part of it is, you know, to be honest, you know, getting all of a sudden having been in my own management company, I took 17.5% instead of 20%. You know, I just thought, you know, I'm going to be learning a whole lot while I'm doing this besides what I already know, you know. It felt fair. You know, I can look back and when I was writing the book and when I talk to people, I can look back and I don't regret anything I did. I didn't screw anybody and I'm glad.
So maybe we can list out the ingredients of a trusted advisor. Be fair.
Be fair. Be honest. Be up front. You got something to say because something's going on that you don't like, say it. Let the people know up front before you get involved with them that, you know, you're going to hold them accountable to do their part, and you're willing to be held accountable to do your part.
As the band manager, were you there, in quotation marks, leader?
Did I do what? Say that again.
As the band's manager for the management company, you were the leader. Am I correct?
Of the business side.
Yeah. Perhaps you could give other leaders and other businesses just one leadership tip. What would that leadership tip be, Ed?
Be straightforward.
Be straightforward.
Yeah, don't BS anybody. Just be straightforward.
Right.
And respect who you're talking to. That's another one. That's the second. Respect is very important.
Respect.
That's how you get it back. If you respect them, there's a good chance they're going to respect you. You know, when you tell somebody you're going to do X, Y, and Z, go do X, Y, and Z.
So
you know, if you can't do it, then go to the people and say, I can't do it. I tried to do it. It's just not, I can't get it done. Be honest.
Right. In the last couple of minutes, I got to ask a couple of questions about where you've been for the last 15 or 18 years. You moved from the music business to the business of coaching people.
I moved this way. I moved from New York City. My wife decided she wasn't working with me in the music industry, and we shut it down anyhow, which was okay. We wanted to make some money out of it. We didn't want to invest a whole lot more, and we would have had to. But it was time to change. and went to Philadelphia. She went off to Temple University for a law degree. I went into sales for my brother, who had a fairly large 1,000-student computer repair school, technical school, 1984, coordinating his 10 salespeople. Well, that got to be a point where, wait a second, I'm closing business that they're sending in and I'm not getting paid on it. So one of the salespeople said, well, then you better take a kit, you know. Those days they used the word kit, and go out on the street and show us what you can do. Well, I went out on the street and I was number two for the month in closing business, not number one. I couldn't get the last couple ones. So that made me director of sales. Then he bought three schools down here, medical assistant, dental assistant, that kind of stuff, down in Maryland. And I came down to be director of admissions for all three. He sold those. I stayed in that business for a while. And then, which you probably know, the school I was working with went under. And I came. My son was born, and my wife was going back to work, and he was 3 months old. And I stayed home with him for a year and found a job with Sandler Sales Institute as one of their coaches. And not that I knew what a coach was in those days, but between a woman named Debbie, who was head of the department, and Sandler was alive in those days, watching them work, I picked up on it. From there, after 6.5 years, I ended up on my own. They were doing some stuff that it was time to leave. And I ended up opening up my own company, which I became a independent contractor for Objective Management Group, one of the best tests in the world. And I was 14 years there, and then it was time to let's go a little semi-retirement. Still doing a little coaching and still would like to pick up a few more clients. Mm-hmm. Not 20 well, of them, but, four or five more would be really nice. People like yourself who are you own the company, you're a CEO of the company, you're in the sales force development arena, and you're also emotionally tied into your company, and sometimes that could get in the way without you even seeing it. That's what
sure.
I heard.
Sure.
And here I am, years later, talking to you that I met way back in your early Sandler days.
Sure, sure. That must have been, what, 93, 94?
I was there until 93 is when I came on board, and I was there until 99, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I was one of your trainers.
That's how you were one of the coaches.
That's right, one of the coaches. That's the best word for it.
One of the coaches.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I want to thank you for being on the show today, and appreciation of being on the show. We're going to send you down one of the new Sandler books.
Oh,
and,
please do.
Yeah, Sandler's just turning out a ton of books. He really would have appreciated it. Again, Ed, thanks for being on the show. Good. Okay.
My pleasure, Michael. I appreciate it. And anything I can do for you, I will. And for those that are out there listening, go have fun. Amazon.com has got the book. You just have to put in the whole title, Joint Venture, A Backstage Rock and Roll, or you put in Ed Kleinman's name with a K.
Good. Okay. Scott, why don't you take it away?
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, contact Mike at MikeRoth@RothConsulting.net or call Mike at 513-753-9400.